thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.
It is very easy for somebody to say, well, I can do it in the E. Why do I need somebody in the F? As an NFO, as a Rio, and then a Wizzo, I always tried to strive to make sure that in my cockpit, 1+1 was more than 2.
Hello, my name is Vincent Aiello, call sign Jello. I am the founder of the Fighter Pilot Podcast and your usual host. But as you audio listeners know, I'm not your only host. I am assisted over there by a couple former military aviators. One is an Air Force flight test engineer, Ken Katz, and the other is a retired naval flight officer, Matt Arney, who joins me in studio for the first time. Flounder, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be down here in the studio and enjoying all you got around here.
Yeah, well, we've had a good time so far, and now we're going to talk about naval flight officers, but we've had you help out with the audio, and we've done some video that we'll talk about before, but I think this is really going to be your first time coming on film with me, so glad for that. Thank you.
That's right. Been able to do a couple of the video things, but living up in the Pacific Northwest, you know, it's nice to get down here to San Diego in the studio and join you for a couple of days.
Well, so I thought a way to introduce you on camera for everyone would be to talk about naval flight officers. So we'll get to your background in a second, but tell us, I mean, what is a naval flight officer?
Naval flight officer is the collection of people who are not the pilot in a lot of the airplanes, officers who help with co-pilot duties in some cases, but running weapon systems in the variety of airplanes we have. We have NFOs. Of course, in the F-18F Super Hornet, we have them in the Growler, we have them in the P-8 Poseidon. So they go across platforms, and we'll talk a little bit about pipeline and how you get into each one. But they run those kinds of duties. They can be mission commanders, but they perform different things in the different phases of flight for the different platforms. Yeah.
And there are Air Force equivalents, obviously not naval flight officers, but they have them as well. I think you missed the E-2 Hawkeye.
Yep, that's right.
And then, of course, that used to be that they're gone now, but in the F-14, which is where you started, as we'll find out, you had the Rios, and then the Prowlers, I guess they were ECMOs.
They were ECMOs,
okay,
that's right.
Fantastic. Well, before we get to all that, let's start with you. Now, as our Patreon listeners know, because you joined me for a happy hour, you and I go way back, but for everyone else, give us a quick summary of where you're from and what you did in your career.
Yeah, so I grew up in a Navy family. My dad flew F-4s. He was a pilot, flew in the Vietnam era. He was a test pilot. And so I came to be at Pax River and joined the career path in the family at that point. And then he went off to do a department head tour in Virginia Beach. So I lived there for a little bit. But then we settled around the D.C. area. And so I mainly grew up in the D.C. area. But I just always wanted to fly in the Navy. That was from the influence of being a little kid around it. And then even though my dad didn't keep flying, I had plenty of family friends who did, the Navy uncles. And so I just continued to live around that influence and loved it and always what I wanted to do.
Well, tell us about your career.
So I went into the Naval Academy through the Naval Academy Prep School and enjoyed my time there. And then after that, there was in that early 90s where I think we go through periods in the pipeline where there's a long wait. So I actually went out to Point Magoo and joined VX4 Vampires as a stash ensign out there. So got to really enjoy flying in different platforms and experiencing the fighter community. And so then I went off to flight school in Pensacola and was able to persevere through the training to get an F-14 spot. And went to Oceana to fly the F-14 Tomcat, went to the RAG VF-101 at the time, and then into the VF-102 Diamondbacks, which is, of course, where we met.
When yeah, you same were, air wing.
Yep, mm-hmm. In the Sidewinders and CAG-1. Did a couple cruises there. And then you know, we have the choice, basically, as a lot of listeners know, you can go into Top Gun route, or you can go into test and evaluation, or you can go into training either at the RAG as an instructor or down in the VTs. And that VX4 experience for me, really, I knew when I left VX4 at Point Magoo, it's like, no matter what happens in my life, I said, I have to get back here. and I managed to do that. Timing was right. I was able to go out there as F-14B upgrade operational test director. Had a great time there, flying F-14s out of Southern California and enjoying that experience. And then continuing on, went to be an assistant navigator on the Enterprise. So got completely out of the cockpit to go do something different. And that was a lot of fun. And then I screened for Department Ed, went to the Jolly Rogers, joined them for a Tomcat cruise, did the transition to the Super Hornet. And then after that, I went to the War College, screened for command of the War College. So got to, again, had time to kill. So I went out to Abu Dhabi to work in the embassy in Abu Dhabi for a temporary assignment and met my wife there. And so then brought her from the wonderful living of Dubai to Lemoore, California for our time there and joined the Black Knights VFA 154 in the Super Hornet. After that, went to operations officer on Abraham Lincoln, joined him on deployment, brought him into Norfolk for midlife overhaul. And then figuring out, you know, kind of where things were going to go. And we realized we wanted to get overseas and still wanted to keep doing Navy as long as it continued to be fun. So we applied for the attaché program. I went to the embassy in Stockholm and did a couple years there, screened for major command in the VX. So then we went from Stockholm to China Lake. And then some issues came up. I couldn't fly anymore. So that's when I got reslated up to Whidbey Island. Did 3 years up in Whidbey Island as a commanding officer. Really great position to leave the Navy from. So we elected to retire, and now I'm up in the Pacific Northwest.
Very good. I've still never been to Whidbey Island. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Wow.
I need to find a way to get up there. Never, not even a gas and go or anything.
Yeah. Well, that was the only reason I'd been up there in the past was just gas and go. I hadn't been off the flight line until my wife and I went up to go check it out over a long weekend, and it's a beautiful place.
So you've done a lot of different stuff, and you didn't always just stay in the cockpit. You went and did navigator tour, like you said, or assistant navigator, but still, it's on the carrier, which you'd served on, so now you're seeing a different side of that operation. So was that, you think, unique, as we sort of unpack NFOs today, was that sort of unique to being an NFO that you had these other opportunities, or just you, Matt Arney, wanting to do different things?
I think that I'd say it's a combination.
Okay.
For me, you know, I grew up knowing that I couldn't be a pilot because I had a lazy eye, and so I had it surgically corrected, but I never got my stereo vision. So I knew that I couldn't qualify to be a pilot. So I just always wanted to be an NFO once I knew that. And I wanted to fly off of aircraft carriers, and I wanted to fly fighters. Mm-hmm. But when it came time for that decision, I knew when I went to go be an assistant navigator, I mean, a lot of coming back into the community is networking and, you know, people pulling you back in when you're so far removed. And so when it was time for me to come back in, it was from a point of I've been on the outside and I was really hungry to get back in. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed the time. So I think it was a more personal thing for me because there are pilots who do those other jobs as well. But anybody can do those. And so back to your question, I think it's really a combination.
Yeah.
NFO allows you to do it. I mean, I could jump in the cockpit pretty easily when I was in those non-flying things, but I didn't really pursue it as much because I always had in the back of my mind, I've had my time. There are other people who need that time. Mm. I'd rather just enjoy doing what I'm doing right now and then enjoy flying when I can fly.
Well, it's a mature way to look at it that maybe not everyone would, you know.
Mm.
I'm going to get mine and you can get what's left kind
yeah,
of thing.
That's right.
But all right, so I sometimes start episodes or interviews, I should say, with like caveats or almost like alibis, like when we come back from the debrief, you know, from a flight to debrief. And I feel like we should do that here because a couple things. You almost never hear about someone who wanted to be an NFO, but, oh, settled for pilot. So that's one thing I want to talk about. And the other is, and it's, I hope, good-natured, but, you know, I came from a single-seat community. I don't ever honestly remember, like, consciously being a, quote, NFO hater. Mm-hmm. Because why would I want to, you know, you're a friend. Why would I hate on you? But there is some natural, I don't know what to call it, right? But
yeah, of course. Some ribbing, teasing, yeah. Banter.
So I don't know if there's even a question in that, but right. I mean, an NFO is not like, you're not less of a person than me because I happen to be a pilot, but you had, in your case, a vision thing that kept you from being, if I may go vertically here, a pilot. So in a sense you settled. And I feel like that sort of maybe ekes its way into the community. Like you almost know that we wanted to do one thing, but we ended up doing the other. And somehow, again, for a guy who comes from single seat, it's very easy, if I were that kind of person, to say, oh, you know, you couldn't handle it, or you're less than perfect or whatever. And so, again, I don't know if there's a question in all this, but...
No, I think that there's a dynamic in there that, you know, you run across. And so there are times when, because not everybody's jello. I mean, you and I have had great relationship through our Arabian adventures and other things in our career path where we keep running into each other.
Yeah.
But there are other people who didn't feel like there is a place for NFOs. And when you look at, for example, the Hornet, you know, the Super Hornet, the E and the F model, it is very easy for somebody to say, well, I can do it in the E. Why do I need to drag somebody else and sacrifice 800 pounds of gas or whatever it is to have somebody in the F? And we can get into, you know, there's so many things you can do in that cockpit. So if you, for example, have somebody who is better at running the Maverick, you know, and attacking with a Maverick.
Like the missile, the AGM-65, yeah.
Yeah. You know, and then the other person might be more experienced in the HARM or AARGM now, then, you know, there is value in having that when there's so many mission sets to go through. Yes, a single person can do it. And it always goes back to, as an NFO, as a Rio, and then a WISO, I always tried to strive to make sure that in my cockpit that 1 + 1 was more than 2.
Yeah.
And there were certainly NFOs who we ran across who that equation didn't work out. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes a challenge when you do have NFOs who are not up to par, and it's a struggle, especially against the mentality of others have that, why do we even have NFOs to begin with?
Well, and I think, I don't know. Again, maybe I'm just me, but I just always thought that's just a ridiculous question because we do. Because, you know, if you go back to the F-4, and you can maybe speak to this better than I can, the F-14, when they were building those aircraft in the 50s and 60s, the technology was such that it was too much for one person.
That's
so
right.
You needed someone to run the radar.
Well, yeah. The F-14, right? You needed somebody to run all those circuit breakers and back. So, right. I mean, you compare that, you know, the F-4 with all the systems and the pilot did pilot stuff and the Rio did Rio stuff. Yeah. And then you compare that with the F-35 now, where we have so much more technology that the airplane could do so much more, but it can present it in a way that your single-seat WISO in that cockpit, who is just running the weapon systems, can do great things in that cockpit. And that cockpit can do a lot more than those older ones can do.
Yeah, I had that, I think, on my outline for later. But, I mean, it's such an interesting concept because, you know, you look at the F-16, let's say, or the F-35 or the A-10, we think of those as single-piloted. But now we're starting to think about single-NFO'd aircraft because you're more of managing all those systems, which is what you did, right, if I can speak for you, in the back of the F-14 or the F-18F, and you're managing all those. But I will tell you this. So, like I said, I don't think I was ever a WISO hater. I'll let others decide if I was.
I never got that from you.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
But I never was as much of a WISO appreciator or NFO appreciator as I was when I went to the weapons school, where I served with your brother, by the way, Skip. And I flew with Skip or Ofer or Steiny or some of these guys who wore Top Gun patches because they had the metal to get through and do that. And I would do what I was used to doing, single seat, but let's say we're doing some sort of air-to-air tactic, and instead of pointing at the threat, now I'm pointing away. And I would look down at my display, and instead of me having to make it show me what I need, it's already showing it because Ofer or Steiny or Skip or somebody did it. Mm-hmm. I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. Now I can sweeten up what I'm doing, or I have better SA. Now, in some cases, to be fair, because they were the ones talking air traffic control, my SA was a little reduced because I'm used to doing that. So I'd approach the altitude and like, whoops, you
know, that's right.
Gotta stop here because I hadn't said it out loud.
Exactly.
So, but the other thing is, and we've talked about this on the show, I feel like, is you're right. I flew both the E and the F. And as an E pilot, I felt like I could do everything I could do in the F. But the F has an extra mission, not just the, what the aircraft can do, but the mission of basically FAC-A, which I never did. But as I understand it, although there are single-seat FAC-As in the Air Force, in the Navy, it's really great to have that division of labor because of all the coordination you're doing with everybody else. So not just the aircraft, but the missions.
That's right. And there's a great episode on the Tomcast about the FAC-A with PK Averna. And, you know, it was such a powerful and inspiring mission to be able to do because you're working closely with ground force elements. You're coordinating multiple, you know, in really advanced scenarios, multiple stacks. You're dealing with different threats. So it was a very dynamic mission. As you said, yes, there are single seat airplanes that do it, usually do in section. So you're doing that, you know, sharing the load between a couple cockpits. And so certainly with us in the two seat that we could kind of do that same thing just within the same cockpit and do task shedding and to be successful in those missions. So
yeah,
a lot of fun.
And the challenge for me at that point when in my career, when I started flying with Wizzos was that I just wasn't used to it. I'd spent so much of my career just effectively doing what I want, but also having a wingman, but now telling, you know, somebody else, hey, we're going to turn hard suddenly, so get ready, or, you know, this
or
is
don't what, tell them. Or, yeah, they'll figure it out.
This is what I'm thinking. But anyway, all right, yeah. So enough slobbering about how important NFOs are. you can see I'm equal opportunity here. Talk to me about selection and training. So, right, you went to the academy. I went to ROTC. I remember racking and stacking, so I'm guessing the selection is pretty easy. But just to set the baseline, when I went to flight school, probably about the same time, the early 90s, you go to primary in a propeller-driven plane, T-34 for me, T-6 these days. Then I went to intermediate jet because I selected jets, advanced jet, went to the boat, went to the FRS, boom, F-18 pilot. What is the, if there are any differences on selection, but what is the training like for an NFO?
So, again, I can speak to how it was a few years ago. What I experienced, we all go through API together. And so it was 6 weeks of weather and engines and, you know, all that kind of aerodynamics and theory. Yeah. And then split off pilots and NFOs. And so then with the NFO pipeline, I went to VT-10, which we flew T-34s. We actually started with the basic pilot training. So they put us in the front of the T-34 so we could do a little bit of piloting for, I think it was like 10 or 12 hours. And then we got into more of the navigation training. So we did that in the T-34. And then somewhere in there, out of API, the Maritime Patrol guys split off.
And right away?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So they're going to go, at that time it was the P-3, these days the P-8?
Mm-hmm. That's how it was back then for us. Okay. And so then in T-34s, we did all that basic navigation and flight training. And then we went into the T-39. And so the T-39 was our platform to do jet-based navigation training, radar intercept training. It had a radar in the nose that we could do basic intercept stuff. We did low-altitude navigation training over Alabama, Florida, that area. Mm-hmm. And so you run through the curriculum there. And then at the end of that, we did T-2s. For spin and basic fighter maneuvers, those kinds of things. So it wasn't until you got your wings at the end of all that that you selected for F-14s or Prowler or S-3. And then at that point, you went off to your dedicated rag.
Mm-hmm. FRS, yeah. Okay. And so was CQ and even CQ for pilots these days is they're talking about getting rid of it because of PLM. That was one of your episodes. Thank you. But was CQ part of the training VT, if you will, the before winging?
No, we didn't do it. The only thing we did was we would do like case 3 training in the simulator.
Okay.
With holding and stuff, trying to manage holding. But otherwise, we didn't do any kind of obviously, you know, landing the T2. Sitting in the back seat, we were introduced to landing, you know, the AOA and lineup and angle, you know, meatball providing, lineup, angle of attack, yeah, you know, so backup.
Providing information.
That kind of
okay.
stuff.
Okay. So, again, today, like the Marine Corps, as I understand, has or is training its last NFO, interestingly. But in the modern day, essentially, we have, again, we talked about the P-8, the E-2, the EA-18 and the FA-18F. But back then you had also the S-3, like you just acknowledged, but the A-6 as well. So what was the point of the training up through getting your wings particular to a platform, or was it particular to these are the different things you might have to do in the fleet depending on what platform you go to? So navigating, communicating, crew coordination maybe is part of it as well.
Yep.
So, and then you get the specific when you pick a platform?
That's right. It was really to prepare you for any of those platforms. So it was kind of generic across all those platforms. And interestingly, we had A6 BNs as instructors, but A6 was not an option when I went there. That was already done. Mm-hmm. But it was really great getting that kind of training. And F-14s at the time were just, when I was at VX4, they were doing the Bombcat operational test and evaluation. So that was just, mission set was just coming to the F-14. But again, because of that A6BN influence and kind of general land attack training that we got, then you could go into the F-14 and learn it there.
Now, you quipped earlier about all the circuit breakers, which anyone who's seen Top Gun Maverick can remember. Was it Rooster jumps on?
That's right.
What is all this?
I laughed out loud at that scene in the theater.
Good. But like, so you get through VF 101, now you're at VF 102, you and I are both nuggets on the George Washington cruise. What would be like your duties as an F-14 Rio?
So first of all, it was co-piloting. You know, it was just backing up the aviating aspect of getting the airplane around.
Although there were no actual flight controls in the back.
No flight controls.
But it's still...
Funny story, though.
Yeah, go ahead.
There's a good friend of mine who, he came in, I don't know if you remember Palms Riles.
Yeah, he
was a nugget on our second cruise. Mm-hmm. And he told me a story when he was a midshipman. And I think that this was something that Tomcat pilots kind of did with midshipmen is... You could go half action on the trigger in the back, and there was a little circle that would show up on the display there, the TID, and on the pilot's repeat. And so they would say that you can take control of the airplane. You don't have a throttle, but if you just go half action and you move that around, you move it forward, the trees get bigger, move it back, they get smaller, all that kind of stuff. And so they would just mirror it with the stick gently. So it wasn't until he came back into the platform, he's like, that son of a bitch.
You realize you've been punked?
Yeah, exactly.
Someone, you mentioned the Tomcast earlier. One of the guests on the F-14 Tomcast, our sister show, talked about that too.
Yeah.
He had a guest pilot from another country and did the same thing. So. Yeah, I never had never got a flight in the Tomcat.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway.
Yeah, good fun. But yes, no controls in the back. And so it was, you had a digital display up top. Where in the F-14A and the B, you saw the raw radar returns in pulse or pulse Doppler. And then you had a TID, the tactical information display, in the center, which is where you did a lot of your mm-hmm. stuff from. And the F-14B upgrade, we had, I think it was called the CDNU, but it was a controlled unit on the left that was your keyboard for entering information into the mission computers for navigation and things like that. You had the squawk in the back. You know, you had a armament panel. So these things that you couldn't fly the F-14 without like turning the squawk on, or if you need to do something on an armament panel or put something in a navigation system, those things just weren't in the front seat. They were all in the back seat. So you couldn't fly it without somebody in the back seat. Mm-hmm. So back to, okay, I have all those things. What am I doing with them? So I am running the navigation. As you alluded to in the two-seat with the Super Hornet, we did the communication with air traffic control agencies, some of the interflight communication, especially if, you know, I'm the strike lead and I'm in the back seat, then I'm doing interflight communication. But the pilots are doing that more tactical pilot-to-pilot communication. It's not that they couldn't get on the radios. They could, and there was good reason for them to be on the radios. We could... launch weapons from the back, but that was all done up front. I mean, it makes sense that the pilot is looking out and seeing that, you know, the weapons are clear and all that kind of stuff. So in that crew coordination aspect, when we had the lantern pod, I'm running the lantern pod for targeting and then getting it all set up, and the pilot's using his or her cues to get it on the proper running and then pushing the pickle button. Mm-hmm. So all those things were very well choreographed through our crew coordination.
Yeah. And crew coordination is something that Top Gun, I mean, I think the FRS has taught it also, because there's a certain amount of, if you and I were going to go jump in one of these airplanes, we would just need to make sure we sort of know the division of labor and the complement of backing each other up.
But at Top Gun, there was a whole class on that. Like, hey, we think this is the best way to do it. Pilot duties are this, Rio or Wizzo duties are that. And if you do it well, as you stated earlier, you can really be more effective than one person by himself. I remember Chili Culpepper. I'm sure you remember him as well. So he and I were at Top Gun together. He had come from the F-14, but then got trained in the F-18. Strangely, they wouldn't let that go the other way. I remember approaching Stroker. I was like, hey, can I get trained in the Tomcat? Like, no, Jello. Anyway, so Chili had said, you know, with the right Rio, to your earlier point, he felt he could be more effective with someone where there is that good sync and you understand each other and you maybe even have flown together a lot versus if you're on your own, now you're doing everything by yourself. So on the other hand, if you're battling, hey, no, I need you to do this, or hey, pilot, you should be turning that way, not this way, then I would think that could also degrade from that as well. So both the training and at Top Gun, there's really best practices of, hey, we think this is how you can be most effective in this platform.
That's right. And that was really great. You know, the F-14, when I got into it, it was pretty clear delineation. And so it was really good to go into it, adopt that. You know, our whole squadron ran off of that same mentality. And so, I mean, rarely did you have problems in the flight because everybody kind of expected that things were going to go this certain way. The targeting is going to be done this way. We're going to be flowing this direction. So it wasn't like there were reasons to have big fights about we should be turning this way or that way. What are you doing? Obviously, it happens sometimes, but sometimes it's just whoever's making the decision makes it with the best information they have, and then you continue to execute the mission and you debrief it afterwards.
That's right.
But interestingly, when I finished at 102, some of my friends were starting to go to VFA 122 out in Lemoore as the Super Hornet RAG was standing up. And I chose that I wanted to still invest more time in the F-14 and realize my life goal of going back to Point Magoo. So I stayed in the Tomcat community for a few more years. But as I listened to the conversations coming out of Lemoore, a lot of it was about this crew coordination aspect. You had A6BNs, you had F-14 Rios, you had F-18 pilots all trying to come together to figure out in a non-missionized cockpit. This was the early lot Super Hornets. How do we share responsibilities? How do we have a standard for crew coordination in these low lot F-18F Super Hornets? And I'm so glad there were good people in there trying to bring the best of all those and come up with a way. Mm-hmm. When I joined the Super Hornet, I had the fortune of joining in a missionized cockpit when I came into VFA 103 when we transitioned. So it was a little more clear the delineation when you're in a missionized cockpit versus basically just a repeated cockpit.
Yeah, so an FA-18B, let's say, is basically just a pure trainer. It has backseat controls for an instructor to ostensibly teach the pilot in the front. An F-18D could be both, and we won't waste any time on that. But an F-18F could either have controls in the back and still be flown solo because you can just soloize it, as we used to call it, or it can be missionized. And tell me what that means. And as I understand, there's different, basically they can put in some hand controllers that are a little more effective for Wizzos to not have to keep taking their hands off, because it can also act like as a brace, but also it's just like being like trained like a piano player, like, you know, every finger is doing something, or?
That's right.
Okay.
So it was, you know, when I first flew the Hornet, I flew an F-18B when I was at VX4, and it was just stick and throttle, you know, don't touch nothing unless I tell you you can touch something. But then I think I only flew one time in an F-18F that was not missionized. We went out bouncing when I was at 103, when I was at the VFA 106 as we were going through as a squadron. And I got in that thing after flying a missionized cockpit for so long. I was like, I have no idea what to do here. And it was a lower lot airplane. That's what it was. It wasn't a stick and throttle. It was the lower lot original kind of hand control,
okay,
which was clunky at best. And there were just buttons did different things, and there weren't as many as I was used to and all that kind of stuff. So back to your point about the piano player, flying in a missionized cockpit with the, I always called it HOS instead of HOTAS. It's hands-on side sticks.
Because you had these throttle.
Yeah, exactly.
HOS?
Right. Yeah, because you have these two side stick controllers, and your thumbs and your fingers are just doing stuff. Mm-hmm. Going. Yeah, you had basically three displays across and one up top, and you could just move your cursor around. And as we also progressed through the software, getting fleet feedback is important. It goes back to the mantra of never fly the A model of anything, because we're just trying to get it out there and then we're going to continue developing it. And so, you know, we continue to make software improvements from the fleet inputs, which really made those side stick controller inputs just powerful. You could program stuff ahead of time in your mission set so that you could swap displays if you wanted to, or, you know, just do different things with those buttons and switches on the side stick controller. So it really gave a lot of power to the Wizzo back there to do the job well.
And was it not just the controls, but if I remember correctly, was there also, like, you could do something, particularly when the APG 79 came around, you could do something with the radar in the back, I could do something with the radar in the front, and it's not like we're fighting each other.
Yeah.
You'd actually be complementing each other.
That's right. Yeah. With the lower lot airplanes, you'd be fighting each other over stuff. But as it got missionized, and like you said, with AESA radar, which I flew in 154, I had the pleasure of always progressing in platforms in my career, which was really great. I have friends of mine who had to take steps backward, and it was, I felt bad for them. But yeah, you could, you know, the airplane was in air-to-air mode, or it was in air-to-ground master mode. But you could still do stuff separately between the two cockpits, which, again, gave a lot of power to that kind of platform.
Sure. So, for example, in the old days, if I am, let's say, flying in my F-18C and I'm going on a strike fighter mission, so I'm trying to deal with the air-to-air picture, but at some point, I need to attack a target. So at some distance from it, I need to commit myself to that and forget about everything else. And then once I'm done with that, then I can look back at air-to-air. In a two-seat where I can divide that, maybe you can start working on the target while I keep a little longer looking outside, and now that range that I'm heads down, in a sense, is reduced. And when you say, okay, it's time to roll in or whatever, then we can shorten that distance. Is that effectively one benefit?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we're on the strike route, and I'm going to be running the air-to-air picture in the back seat. And then at a certain point, I'm going to transition to focusing on the air-ground picture, make sure, you know, I pick out the target and all that kind of stuff. And you're going to be flying your cues to get us on the right run-in line. But like you said, you can be task sharing between that and the air-to-air picture while I'm heads down. And then we can transition. Okay, you've got everything you need to pickle the weapon. I'm still going to be backing you up on that. But at the same time, I could start looking at what's that off-target picture going to be looking like, so we can be ready to go as we come off target. Mm-hmm.
All right, so I want to step back to a couple topics we've already talked about. So you were the skipper of VFA 103.
Of VFA 154.
154, that's right.
Yeah. You were 103 department head.
Okay, very good. Mm-hmm. So you said an F-14 cannot, should not probably, but cannot be flown without someone in the back, because there are certain things you have to control.
Even just administrative flight, you know.
Right.
You got to turn the squawk on and stuff like that.
Right. But an F-18, like at the FRS, it's not uncommon for a two-seat to go out when there's not somebody in the back. And again, they'll just soloize it. And a lot of two...
And a little part of me dies every time that happens.
And that's my question. So a lot of two-seat squadrons, like 154, if I may speak for them, or 41 or whoever, like, would not fly without someone in the back. And I never quite understood if it was sort of an NFO protection program, excuse me for asking.
Yeah, sure.
Or if it was like, no, this is a two-seat squadron. We have a two-seat aircraft, and that's just the standard, is we're just going to always fly it with someone in the back. And the only reason I ask is I remember there were times where, like, well, but if we flew it empty backseat over there, we could solve this problem we have with picking somebody up with a broken jet or whatever. And it almost seemed like, no, we can't be done. So I don't know, again, if there's a question in there or not, but...
Well, yeah, so there were different squadron cultures with that. And so certainly, to your point about a parts run or something like that, yeah, I mean, as I was a commanding officer, I would love to have a Wizzo in the cockpit all the time, because basically the flight time's there. Don't complain to me if you're not getting flight time, if you're not taking those opportunities. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if there was some reason... Like if we needed a shuttle, a pilot to go get, you know, whatever the situation is, those one-offs, absolutely. If it makes sense to get the mission done, then absolutely. But as a norm, I wanted to make sure that every time an airplane took off, there were two people in it.
It was designed to fly fast and at treetop level, carrying 24 nuclear weapons. Today, it bristles with smart bombs and guided missiles. The B-1 bomber, called the Bone by those who fly and maintain it, is the most heavily armed bomber ever built. Sleek and powerful, the Bone remains a mainstay of American air power 50 years after its first flight. Hey everyone, this is Ken Katz, call sign Primetime, and my book, The Supersonic Bone, A Development and Operational History of the B-1 Bomber, tells the true story of this magnificent airplane. In this book, you'll read stories told to me by those who were there and see lots of great photos of the Bone. Anyone with an interest in modern military aircraft will enjoy reading The Supersonic Bone, available through the usual online retailers and aviation booksellers. Pick up your copy today.
First of all, I mean, it's just like, we're a 2-seat squadron, so we're going to fly 2-seat. We can always practice crew coordination, navigation. And I got so much, you know, those like cross-country flights, you know, they're boondoggle to wherever. You know, you don't have to be intensely training the whole time, but that's where you really get into systems and other things. So there was a lot of value in just making sure people had access to that.
The other thing I wanted to circle back to was crew coordination. And an F-14, because there were certain things that could only be done in the front or in the back, there was, I would assume, some degree of this is how we think we're going to do it because this person has to do certain things, this person has to do certain things. In an F-18F, although the controls might be different, effectively, correct me if I'm wrong, with the exception of, I think, shooting or dropping bombs, pretty much anything can be done in any seat. So did that drive, you talked about a bunch of smart people showing up at VFA 122 to figure this out. But whereas before it's like, well, we don't have a choice. This is what we have to do. And then let's just optimize that. Now I feel like you really could say, hey, the back seat could do everything and the front seat could just drive the bus, or front seat could do everything and the back seat could just be there to assist if necessary. So I feel like maybe it opened the aperture for what crew coordination would look like. I don't know. Was that the case?
I think so. I think that you're absolutely right. You could say the pilot in an F-18 is going to be a chauffeur and the wizard is going to take care of everything. And it just doesn't make sense because you're not maximizing the value of the person up front. And if you go the other way, you're not maximizing the value of the person in back. So I think having the tension, and I know at least my perspective from the outside of that conversation, there was a lot of tension. There was a lot of agendas coming from the different platforms. Damn it, we did it this way. This is the way we need to do it. And they didn't, it's not like they came out of some conference with the solution. It continued to be iterated upon as we continued to develop the capability of the platform itself through software. So it was a really necessary process. It kind of speaks to the value of tension and conflict, you know, good conflict. Yeah. To come up with the right solution.
Well, healthy conflict, right?
Yeah.
Because you want to have those discussions because the person who's saying this is how we used to do it might be forgetting that that's how you had to do it because the squawk was only in the back seat.
That's
so
right.
So you had to do certain things a certain way. And now it's like, hey, wipe the slate clean. Yeah, that's parochial, but now it's a different animal. So let's figure out how to best do it. Yeah, no, interesting stuff. All right, so you know about this, but for everyone else, we have a Patreon page, and people there know you're coming, and you've even asked them to provide you questions for some of the interviews you've conducted. So I told them you and I were going to sit down and talk about NFOs. Some of them are going to ask about other stuff, too. But we'll start with the first one. Nick Brown, what is the difference between a RIO and a WIZO beside the acronym?
So RIO, Radar Intercept Officer, comes from, as far as I know, from the F-4 to F-14 days. And remember that platform, you know, we could launch Phoenix missiles out to 100 miles against the big Russian, the Soviet bomber attack, and 6 Phoenix missiles at long distance. So it was a lot of running radar intercepts. And there was no air-to-ground mission. So it kind of made sense as a name. And it's something that we took great pride on. Even though we took on the Bombcat mission, we were still RIOs. And so, again, there was a little bit of, okay, F-18Fs are replacing F-14s, so we should be RIOs. Okay, I got it. Marine Corps had already taken the weapon systems officer nomenclature, and the Air Force also used that in the F-15E Strike Eagle. And so it makes sense because we're running multiple weapon systems. So the name's different. The background is a little different, but the role is really the same.
Yeah.
You know, back up the aviating, the navigating, and the communicating, and run the weapon systems.
Yeah. It's just like you wouldn't necessarily bring over the BN, bombardier navigator term, from the A6, because that's not all you're doing. And at the time those aircraft were designed, like you said, we need someone to run the radar. So that's how that name probably came around on the F4, let's say. Or, hey, we need someone to work the navigation and get the bombing ready. So the pilot just flies, as I understand from the books, you know, fly the line, push the button, and the bomb comes off. So you've got a BN. So
yeah, it
makes sense. So a WISO, I feel like, is sort of almost a catch-all term.
That's
right. Not a cop-out, but just...
And I think it speaks to what you're doing. And then you have the ECMO to EWO, so electronic countermeasure officer in the Prowler. And remember, that was a pilot with three ECMOs. And so then we take that community into the Growler, where you have a pilot and an EWO. And so, as I've heard, you know, I flew the Growler a couple times when I was at Whidbey and didn't get a syllabus on how to execute it, but looked at some of the stuff and had a pilot walk me through it as we're in the ranges. But my understanding, if you want to kind of boil it down, is that when we move from the Prowler to the Growler, you take the pilot and the front seat ECMO, combine those into the pilot mission. And then the two ECMOs in back, you're kind of combining that into the EWO, the electronic warfare officer. Mm-hmm. And so in that platform, again, you know, with the Growler, you can do a lot of stuff from both cockpits. And so the pilot's taking on a little more of that responsibility, whereas truly they were just driving the station wagon back in the Prowler days.
In the Prowler, yeah. Well, but also that was the technology we had, right? So when the Prowler was designed, we need a bunch of people to work all these different systems. And now that can be amalgamated, I don't know if that's the right word, into displays that one in the front, one in the back, we can make sense out of what's going on, make decisions based on the Top Gun equivalent. Havoc would come up with their best crew coordination, I presume, and say, hey, this is what the front seat should be doing, this is what the back seat should be doing, and now we can be effective. So
yeah. And then even, you know, you think about the Prowler pilots, you know, when they designed that airplane, I don't know, I haven't talked to them, but just landing that thing aboard the carrier. It's like, you need to focus your whole mission on thinking about how you're going to bring this thing back,
yeah.
You know, navigate around, do you do your little bow ties and stuff like that. But, you know, a lot of your brain power is like, oh my God, I got to bring this thing back.
At the end of this whole mission.
Yeah.
Never mind the mission. At the end, I have to land on the carrier.
But now Growlers with PLM, it kind of goes back to the value of PLM. We're, you know, making it, it's still complex, but we're making it easier. And you can devote some of your brain power to actually being a tactician in that cockpit.
Yeah. Well, speaking of flying in the back of the Growler, Jim Gundog says, thanks for all you do for us. How did you like your time in Oak Harbor and Whidbey? I love the area.
Yeah. You said earlier you haven't been there yet. It really is an amazing area. It's a, you know, Whidbey Island is a, it's like the fourth biggest island in the U.S. It's very long, and it has a lot of wonderful aspects to it. It's up there outside of Seattle in the Puget Sound. So, I mean, bald eagles and peregrine falcons, and life was good. What we really enjoyed about it coming in as the commanding officer there was just the community engagement. Mm-hmm. My wife and I and my kids just love getting out in the community and representing the Navy. And there's a lot of rhetoric and discourse that comes out of the community, just as there is around any airport, air station, whatever. But a lot of great supporters there in the community, and really enjoyed working with the different organizations, the county commissioners, all the people who support and want to try to work together with the base to be successful.
It's like being a mayor, I understand, when you're a base CO.
Dealing
with a lot of different things.
It is interesting because it is like being a mayor plus, because, you know, mayors don't usually run the airport, or they don't usually run the grocery stores and all that kind of stuff. So you have all those elements to it. So it's, but the community out there is great, and we love the Pacific Northwest living. Thus, we decided to settle there.
There you go. Yeah. All right. You might have answered Jevons already. What was your experience of the differences in tactical crew coordination between F-14s, early Super Hornets with mirrored fore and aft cockpits, and later Super Hornets with missionized cockpits? I think we pretty much covered that one.
Yeah, we have talked about that, and there's some, you know, Jevon, I always appreciate our discourse on, you know, episodes and stuff. But yeah, we've talked a lot about that.
So then let me insert one. You talked about how flying with good crew members can really make yourselves both more effective. What do you do, though, and I'm sure you've had this experience, when you're flying with a pilot who maybe is just either a little weaker or just not getting it? Like, what are some techniques? And I'm guessing it's maybe even similar to as you led squadrons and departments in a base. Like, right, leadership is about dealing with people and solving little problems as you go. But what was it like for an NFO if you had a pilot who hopefully didn't get to the point where it was frightening you, but maybe just not as effective? What were some like techniques that was kind of common maybe for you or at least the NFO community maybe?
Yeah, because you know going into it how the particular pilot's doing. And certainly as you get more senior, you're going to be flying with more junior pilots who have gotten all the training. But maybe they're, you know, as we continue to progress to the syllabus, maybe they're taking a little bit longer to get things. And so you know where your attention's going to be focused for the flight. Is it going to be, hey, I'm going to obviously do what I need to do tactically, but I'm going to be more of a co-pilot today or in this particular phase of flight. I remember one time we were on our Kennedy cruise, our second cruise, and it was a dark and stormy night, of course.
That's how they all start.
That's right. Yeah. And ACLS was down, the automatic carrier landing system. ILS was down, the instrument landing system. And I was flying with the Nugget pilot. And yeah, we'd done ASR approaches in simulators, but I mean, in real life out there where you can't see anything. And so there was a lot of co-piloting. And the first approach did not end up well as we went up the starboard side of the ship when we broke out and had the tower in front of us. And so we, you know, took a quick right turn to get around the ship. But, you know, going back up, settling down, okay, what are we going to do differently this time? You know, that kind of, as well as I'm sure paddles came up and had a talk as well. But that reassuring voice of, hey, it's all good. That's the kind of stuff that you do. And even I remember flying with an experienced pilot. And we had a hydraulic failure in the middle of the night. And you know, just being that calming, reassuring, I knew that, you know, Guido was going to be fine, but I'm there to make life easier, not make life harder. And so, yeah. Oh my God, yeah, we're all going to die.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So my very first non-CQ at C period, I wonder if you were there. It was April of workups for like our George Washington deployment. I had a night in the barrel.
Yeah.
So three bolters, trip to the S3 tanker, two wave offs, because by God, I wasn't going to bolter again subconsciously, and ended up thankfully back at Cecil where I was based. So I slept in my own bed. I came out the next day. And I guess, again, I'm really talking without asking questions today, but just kind of wondering out loud, like, you know, if I'd had someone else with me, I wonder if it had gone that way. But if it still did, like, I wonder how I would felt about, like, I already felt bad, like my ego was shattered, you know, but like how bad I would have felt for that person to say, man, sorry to put you through all that. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's a question there or not, but it was a lonely night. I will say that.
Yeah. Well, so, at least you have somebody there to commiserate with. But I did an interview with Nasty Manazer, and he talks about as a Nugget, you know, he had a night in the barrel, but with no opportunity to go anywhere, you know, blue water and finally gets it aboard, and you know, it's that, who knows if the Rio in this case makes a difference or not, but at least I always wanted to walk away from the flight feeling like I made things better no matter what the outcome was.
Yeah. All right, let's get back to it. David Fine, what did you find most satisfying about your role as commanding officer of NAS Whidbey? See, we keep coming back to Whidbey. And how did that compare to the things you enjoyed about flying?
Yeah, so David, also, I've gotten to know pretty well, so I appreciate the question. I already talked about the community part, and that was probably half the job was, you know, outward. But, and I alluded to it internally, you know, I had fire and emergency services, I had security forces, I had the whole fleet and family readiness, the mental health, the Navy exchange, I had the operations of the base, the public works, all those kinds of things. And so I enjoyed that, like, every 30 minutes was different. You know, I'd focus on the thing that at the time, but I'd go from that to something else. And you have to get up to speed quickly. What's the situation? How can I, you know, why are we talking? How can I help you to get your things done? What resources do you need? Or, you know, what hurdles do I need to take out? And so I enjoyed that aspect. And then, of course, because of that, that also got me around the base a lot and visiting with different people. Visiting with tenants, you know, the P-8 squadrons or the Growler squadrons or all the other tenants that are on the base. So I really love the diversity of the job. It really keeps every day fresh. You never know what's going to happen despite what your schedule has. And I enjoyed you know, my office was right on the flight line, and I had a great view over the runway with Mount Baker in the background. On a beautiful day, you could see Mount Baker, and you'd see those airplanes taxiing by with those, hopefully, JOs in them. And I look out there, I think, you guys have no idea what it takes for you to go take that airplane and go flying every day. And you shouldn't have any idea.
That's right.
Just you need to focus on what you're doing.
Yeah, get good at it.
Yeah. And so I had a Star Hilo squad debt. Mm-hmm. I'd go flying with them every now and then out in the mountains and watch them do their amazing work doing rescue, being able to rescue a growler crew wherever at any time in that area, which is very challenging. And so they'd go out and do community rescues for people who got themselves in extremis, and they do a bunch of those every year. And so it was just really, I think, to answer David's question, it was the variety, it was the pride, and it was just the beauty of the environment we operated in. Yeah. So it really allowed me, you know, when I was the commanding officer at 154, I came up with this mantra of serve proudly, choose to be happy, and follow your core values. And so, you know, I got to live that every day, and I got to interact with sailors and civilians doing their jobs, trying to help them understand what their role was and that their role was important, and then they can also serve proudly, choose to be happy, and follow their core values. So it was a great pleasure.
Yeah. Well, and to David's question, all those tenets could still also apply to flying. I mean, there is variety in the missions that we do, especially in the F-18. It is beautiful at certain times, unless you're about to land on the carrier, then the sunset, you're lamenting a little bit. No, stay up.
That's right.
But no, it's good. All right. So Joe Kunzler, I know is a friend of yours.
Yeah.
Really wants me to ask about OLF Coupeville, but I told him this discussion's about NFO, so he'll settle for a Super Hornet combat story. But let me ask you this. Did you put any green ink in the logbook? You and I sort of did on Operation Southern Watch, mostly patrolling, but do you have any Super Hornet combat stories?
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. I did. You know, when you're around long enough in the last few decades, you'll get there. And so I ended up with, I think it's about 80 or so combat missions total. First one was Basra, you know, in the Tomcat. But when I went to 103, we joined, like I said, on deployment on Kennedy, back to Kennedy. Mm-hmm. And we were there for a Fallujah campaign in the Tomcat. And then we came home, turned the jets in, and we went back out a year or so later. And that was my first exposure to Afghanistan, which I visited there in 103 and then in 154 and some in Iraq. So combat story. So the interesting one, back to the Maverick, we had a particular mission that we were working to do to try to do some kind of counter-terrorist activity in theater.
Is this 03 time frame?
This,
when is
this? This was actually in 2011.
Okay.
When I was on the Black Knights.
All right.
And we were flying mixed section with our Marine squadron, and we had, you know, they were carrying laser JDAM at the time. We weren't approved to carry laser JDAM yet, but we were carrying GBU-12s and LMAV, and we'd been doing LMAV training for this particular mission set. And so it was one of those where we never knew when we were going to have to do it, but I was flying with my pilot, my TACORD pilot, Chris Keene, BJ, who just finished up command at 213. We were FACAs, and it was a lot of the time it was very docile. You know, you're waiting, you're giving information as an airborne ISR asset. But then once the call came in, it was like, you imagine the scene in Ghostbusters when they go in the room and they're all shooting and, you know, it's like, whoa, nice shooting, Tex. But I mean, I think we slicked off both jets, you know, just releasing, you know, a section LMAV delivery and rolling in to GBU-12 deliveries, and we lased for the laser JDAM delivery, and all within a span. I mean, it seemed like it took like 5 minutes, but I think it was like, you know, two or three minutes of action. So very intense, but really gratifying to support that ground force element when they needed it.
Yeah. So I want to try to circle back to then again what we talked about before as far as like crew coordination and the benefit of two in the cockpit. When something like that happened on that night, particularly, let's just use that night, is it, and I hope the answer is going to be the second part of it, but is it, all right, well, now we're doing it for real, so let's just do whatever it takes, and, you know, I'm going to say this or do that, and it's not what I trained to do, or do you fall back on, this is what we've been trained to do, let's do it the way we did, and oh, by golly, it works.
Yeah, it's definitely the latter.
Okay.
I mean, it was because, you know, all that training, you really are into that unconscious competence phase of training, going from an unconscious incompetence all the way up through developing competence mm-hmm. until you're and it goes back to, as again, I just recorded with Nasty Menazer. He's a great reference to Top Gun Maverick and the whole, you know, you don't think, you do. And it's not that you're not thinking up there, but you've trained for it.
You're just so proficient.
You're proficient, yeah. And you're making it happen. And so that's really the gratification that comes from that. And so, yeah, we executed not only inside the cockpit, but with a Hornet wingman, mm-hmm. how we were supposed to work together and how we trained. And so it all came off as it should.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
So we already talked a little bit about your particular career, and you went on to be very successful. You had command of a squadron. You had command of a base. You went off and did some attaché stuff. Again, I think I know the answer to this, but getting back to NFOs, and not versus pilots, but let's call it compared to pilots, are the career opportunities similar? I mean, can you go on to be an aircraft carrier CO or an air wing commander? You didn't do that, but some people might go those directions. Or even admiral, I mean, all the way up to maybe the chief of naval operations. I mean, is there a upper ceiling, if you will, to being an NFO?
No, there's not. And, you know, right now on the Eisenhower Strike Group, Stem Miguez is the carrier strike group commander. And he and I, we were in flight school together, we were in the RAG together, we were in 102 together, and then, of course, we kept, you know, going back and forth throughout our career in department head and command and stuff, and always stayed good friends. And, you know, he's a one-star now. He's had an air wing. He then was selected for admiral, and he did an admiral position, and now he's a strike group commander out there doing amazing work with CAG, Starvin Marvin, who was one of our JOs when I was a department in 103. So yes, you have all the same opportunities. You can be an attaché, you can be an ANAV, and when I say you, I mean a pilot or an NFO. Mm-hmm. And I think that later on, a lot of pilots are just like, I just want to stay in the cockpit, and I get that. But at some point, that ends, and yeah. So there's other things that you can do, and but yeah, you can do all those same things.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we can wrap up, but since you help with the show, I thought we could spend a couple minutes talking about podcasting, particularly since we're going to have you debut your first video, I think probably next episode if we get it right. But I'm reminded of, it's been, I guess, maybe a year now, I was sort of looking out for people to help, and I think at one point when I approached you about it, you said, why me? And I said, well, because you answered the phone. we go way back. We were on the ground in Egypt together and the Netherlands and a few other places deployed, and we've always crossed paths. But I guess I would just ask you, I mean, right? People sit and watch or listen to me, but what have you found is interesting about podcasting, or maybe some of the challenges too? So some of the strengths and weaknesses, or pluses and minuses, however you want to put it, but what have you found in coming alongside me and doing this?
Yeah. So yeah, at that time I just was retiring out of the job at Whidbey Allen. We're getting settled, and I was trying to figure out what I want to do when I grow up. And I knew that I didn't want to just go into the defense industry. Great people in there trying to provide all the great things our warfighters need. I was just looking for something different. And as I was trying to navigate what that career was going to look like, that conversation came up, and, you know, I hadn't thought about going into podcasting. But you already had a great product that you developed. And so it was very easy for me to come in and help out. And so, with a little trepidation, because we all have imposter syndrome as we do things, you know, I just kind of jumped in. And you're a great support for tips and stuff to get me through the fam ride and send me on my way.
That's right.
So I've thoroughly enjoyed it, especially because I didn't initially want to focus my career about being in defense. It's really allowed me to stay connected to naval aviation, yeah, which I love,
yeah,
and military aviation. And so it's been a great joy in that respect. And then really just being able to have these kinds of conversations is a lot of fun. And so that's what I've certainly enjoyed out of it. The challenge is, you know, scheduling, making sure that we have what we think are interesting people, certainly interesting to us, hopefully interesting to the listeners. Certainly, we want to make sure that we provide good content. And so, you know, it's a challenge. It's enjoyable because it allows you to network and talk with people and figure out who you know, wants to come on and talk about their story. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. It's easy, I think, to find guests that maybe have something they want to promote, whether it's mm-hmm. a book or a service or something. And I remember at the time, I think you were, as because you were the CEO, you were doing some speaking engagements, maybe Rotary, I'm not sure. But I think part of the reason I approached you was I thought, well, here's a guy maybe that wants to, you know, quote, build your personal brand, because you put yourself out there. Mm-hmm. And so people get to know you, so they feel like they, you know, they have a inside. So when they want to invite you to come speak or whatever, you know, they get to know you a little better. But for me, I tell you, when I started doing it, all of a sudden, you know, you flip through the channels, you see Larry King and you don't think anything of it. Now, when I see him, I'm like, wow, it's not easy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's not easy. And I've gotten good feedback along the way. And so it's reassuring that I think I'm putting out a product that people enjoy.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's a great adventure through these conversations.
Good. When you think back, and I can only rattle off a couple, but let's see, you talked to OJ about PLM. You talked to, was it Chunky about spaceflight? You had someone, Pink, for NJAD. We never could decide.
Pink was Future of Air Warfare. That was my first one.
Oh, okay.
Because I really wanted to come in and, you know, you do a lot of great historical stuff. I wanted to try to think more about what the future of air warfare looks like.
Okay.
And it's great. And I continue to try to do that, but it's hard to find informed people who want to come on and talk about it.
Yeah.
So space flight's been really fun because we have military aviators who are in space. And then I decided to go deep into some history with the Hobo to Hero, which is just great pleasure to sit down with Art Palmer and talk with them and hear his stories.
That's right. Forgot about that one, too.
Yeah. Is there a favorite? I mean, Yank Cummings. We got Nasty Menazer coming up. I can't say there is a favorite.
Of course. Because like everyone's asking your different. Favorite kid.
Exactly. Yeah. Favorite kid or, you know, what's your favorite tour? It couldn't be the ANAV tour. I'm like, it's up there with every other one of them. Yeah. They're all fun.
Yeah. So. No, that's good. And it's a little bit of a discovery, right? Because you think you maybe know what the interview is going to go like, but then all of a sudden, maybe there's some variable or they go somewhere you didn't expect. I've had some where you ask one question and they talk for 20 or 30 minutes. Like, oh, okay, I gotta be careful with my questions. But yeah, I have a newfound respect for people who do this. I guess I do it for a living, sort of, but for those who do it well, particularly on the national scene. But you've already talked a little bit about space flight. What's coming up? And space is one of them.
That's right. So we've got a really great interview with Reed Wiseman, Tonto, coming up. So Tomcat Aviator, he's the mission commander for the Artemis II mission. And so we were able to go down to Houston to the Johnson Space Center right there in one of the simulators and do a video recording of an hour conversation with him, talking Tomcat stuff, talking FAC-A, talking NASA and Artemis. And so it was a lot of fun. And I hope that viewers and listeners get half as much joy out of the conversation as I got sitting there with them.
Yeah. Well, like we talked about last night over a refreshment, we here on the Fighter Pilot Podcast sort of deliberately don't just go for the most salacious and shortest and sensational topics. We try to be, I guess, maybe like 60 minutes, you know, let's go deep. And if we don't grow as fast as we could otherwise, well, so be it. I think we're both proud of the product we're putting out. So yeah, looking forward to that. I know you've got some other guests lined up. And so I'm glad to welcome you to the video side of things as well, because the more you're doing, the less I have to do. But it does help. And I hope you continue to enjoy it. Yeah. So that's great. Let's finish, I guess, where we started is as far as naval flight officers in general go. I think we talked a little bit about the future, maybe somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but an F-35 pilot has almost become more of a single-seat F-35 Wizzo, although I don't think the Navy's ever going to go to that or any of the others.
Right.
But that's essentially what you're doing is you're assimilating all that information, making those decisions. I think we talked about the training, the career path. What did I not ask you about naval flight officers that maybe watching or listening audience needs to know?
Yeah, I mean, as we look at the future, and you know, I always think about some of the segment of listeners who are younger and maybe aspiring. And so, you know, what are the opportunities? If I can't be a pilot, what can I do if I want to be close to military aviation? Well, first of all, you still have NFOs in P-8 Poseidons, which are relatively new. They're going to be around for a long time with an amazing mission of maritime dominance, and that's going to continue to evolve over time. So, and a very comfortable ride, having been in one. But then you've got your growlers, which are also very essential to our mission set, and they're going to be around and funded well, and they're going to continue to have advancements as we get into next-gen jammer when it comes out and all these kinds of things that that platform does. So there's great opportunities there. And oh, by the way, you get to live in a really wonderful place. I mean,
yeah. We haven't made that clear yet.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. And it's also interesting because, you know, it's not like Whidbey Island is a mecca for electronic warfare, but it's just kind of where it started off organically. And so therefore, we've built up an infrastructure around it. So sure. The Growlers will always be there. We need to go to Fallon or Nellis to have very complex training for the Growler community, but the Growlers will be there. So anyway, you've got that, and you've got the E2 Hawkeye, which E2D is an amazing platform. A lot of really great opportunities for NFOs in that platform. 30, 40 years down the road, I don't know what it's going to look like. I mean,
nobody does.
Yeah, maybe the NFOs will, if you were going to be an NFO, you'll be flying unmanned stuff at that point. Who knows? Okay. But at least for the next few decades, there's a lot of really great opportunity to be a warfighter in airplanes as an NFO. Oh.
Excellent. Well, apart from hopefully continuing to help me with the Fighter Pilot Podcast, thank you. What's the future for you?
So I've got my own consulting company. Can you call it a company when you're one person?
If you've got a website, you can tell us and people can go and decide
right.
for themselves.
But it's CAS Enterprise Management. And I came up for a while, a couple years ago, I came up with this. And CAS, of course, Close Air Support. So, you know, it's always near and dear to my heart. But it's complex, ambiguous, and strategic. When you're running businesses, every problem you run into that's worth getting an outside opinion is going to have those three attributes to it. So I really enjoy coming in and helping out with people trying to solve complex, ambiguous, and strategic problems for companies, regardless of industry. I spent the last couple of years in the technology industry doing commercialization of technology products, and that's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of great learning. And as I continue to kind of move forward in my career, we'll see what kind of opportunities I can create. But I want to continue doing podcasting. Another thing that is very near and dear to my heart, my boys are 10 and 12, and we're deeply embedded in youth sports. Youth lacrosse just started off with the Everett Sea Wolves, so we got our first games coming up this weekend. And so I'm a director of the boys youth program, helping out with that, and then the vice president of the youth football and cheer program that we do in the fall. So we're already planning. Registration opens up for that in March. So, you know, it's really a great pleasure to be able to provide that kind of time because community is important. Opportunities for kids are important. And then scouts, you know, we're a big scouting family, Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, Scouts BSA now. So all those things are keeping me plenty busy.
Okay. All right, final question. I'm not even sure I know this one, but I have a hunch. Matt Arney, call sign Flounder. I wonder if we were maybe our generation just at the tail end of Animal House.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get movies at Farva. There's a lot of Farvas.
That's right.
Blue there are. And yeah. Everybody, but Frank the Tank. But was that it or was it something else?
It was pretty much that. Funny, when I was in flight school, Pensacola, we lived on the beach, had to live on the beach
sure.
there on Perdido
live
Key.
Live it up while you can.
That's right. And we had a volleyball net, and my roommate Eric Bach and I played two-man volleyball, and called him Tuna because he always ended up in the net, and me Flounder because I always ended up in the sand. But later on, you know, I went through, when I was at VX4, it was Hazmat, and you know, you would go through different things. But it wasn't until I came to 102, because my brother had left in May of 96, and then I got there in September of 96, and so it was boom, call signs Flounder, you're a legacy, we had to take you from the Animal House. And so then for my change of command party in Lemoore, we did an Animal House theme toga party in the Oak Club. Had a lot of fun with it and had Animal House, the movie playing. So, yeah, great fun.
Cool. Well, Flounder, thank you for explaining NFOs. And I don't know if right now my pilot buddies are all throwing stuff at, like, oh, come on, man, you're giving them too much credit.
But, yeah, well, my NFO buddies might be throwing some stones at me, too, about things. But that's all right.
Can't please everyone.
That's right.
Yeah, but no, I'm really thrilled to have you alongside on this podcasting journey. And if everything works out the way we hope, the next video episode will feature you and Tonto, so... In fact, we need to record a little bit to go with that. So
that's right.
We should probably knock off and get to it.
Sounds good.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining.
Thank you, Jello. I appreciate all the opportunity you've given me, and it's great to be here in person with you.
This episode of the Fighter Pilot Podcast is adapted from a studio interview conducted at the Circle Air Group FBO on Gillespie Field in El Cajon, California. Visit the Fighter Pilot Podcast YouTube channel to watch this episode and hundreds of other military aviation-themed videos. To learn more about the show, visit our website, fighterpilotpodcast.com. And for exclusive content, check out our Patreon page. Thanks for listening.
Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post 9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.